Hi, welcome to Speaking with Authority. I've got a great guest today. I'm very excited about it. And let me give you a little bit of insight here. Have you ever written an email that nobody responded to or spent time crafting a message that you thought was so clear only to realize that no one understood it or watched a company struggle to explain what they do, even though you think their product is great? Here's the uncomfortable truth. Most people, including smart leaders, are terrible with words. They lose deals, they lose clarity, and lose momentum inside of their organizations. But a small group of people, including my guest today, understand something completely different. They understand the psychology behind the words that move people to act, and why some messages get ignored and why other messages get triggered immediately. So today we're going to talk about why most communication fails, why persuasion actually is a leadership skill, why AI still struggles with real persuasion, and how to understand human psychology, how it can dramatically change the way you communicate with customers, employees, and partners. Today's guest has spent her career studying something most people completely overlook: the psychology of why people say yes. Why do some words spark action? Why do others' words get ignored? Why do companies struggle to communicate with clarity and power? And why others struggle to even explain that basic? So my guest today is one of the pioneers of conversion copywriting, designed not only to help you sound good, but to actually move people to act. She is the founder of Copy Hackers and Copy School, and she's trained thousands of founders and marketers and entrepreneurs on how to persuasion really works. Her work has helped companies generate millions by simply improving how they communicate. And in a word, where AI is generating more contacts than we can ever imagine, she continues to teach something far more value: how to understand the human mind behind the words. So, Joanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. What an intro. What an intro. And I do want to point out right out of the gate, because people will be like, oh, she's a psychologist. No, at all. No, but storytelling and psychology, like understanding people, go hand in hand. So I'm definitely into the storytelling realm and what that means about humans and how we pass.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love that. And sometimes psychiatrists and psychologists don't understand that as much as how the brain works with words. So,
right.
Let me ask your first question here. So what did you first realize that words could actually create economic value?
Later than I should have. So I was already a copywriter for a couple years before I really understood what the job was. So I'd been at an agency. I was the only copywriter there. I was called a creative writer. That was on my business card. And so, you know, you think you're there for creativity, and it's at an agency where creativity is highly valued. Then I went over to the tech giant Intuit and got a job there as a senior copywriter. And I must have been there a solid year before I even realized, like, oh, wow, they're measuring how my copy performs, which nobody had done before. Mm-hmm. They're measuring it to see, are we getting more people to open the email? Are more people clicking through? Are we getting people bouncing when they land on this page? All of this stuff that I hadn't had any clue was my job, which seems shocking, but it's not. There are a lot of people who don't realize what the job of the copywriter is, including the copywriter. So once we started doing A/B testing and I got more involved in that, and this was when A/B testing tools became like everybody, it was democratized effectively. All businesses could use Optimizely or something like that. This was like early 2000s when these tools came out or whatever in there. And so, yeah, so we started doing A/B testing and I was like, oh my gosh, you change one word in a headline and you actually change what people do. And then I went in and did a master's in this in communications and persuasion in online environments, and got to do all sorts of cool research there. And that was when it was like very clear that a lot of us are missing some really fundamental understanding of how our words get people to act, which we all know, but like we're all practicing words all the time. We're all doing this all the time. So you don't stop and really get deliberate and thoughtful about what you're saying. And so you take for granted the same thing with like your audience, right? Like I'll say whatever and they'll eventually figure it out.
Right.
Not great. Not great.
Well, I love the fact that, you know, your epiphany was actually some of the data behind what was being used. And a lot of people don't realize that that A-B testing and how you keep learning from that. And now after you've done it so much, you've probably have a kind of a sixth sense on what works and what's not going to work.
You know, I wish the thing that I have more of is understanding that the thing that's likely to work is the last thing you think will, which is weird. But we've seen this in tests, like one of the early tests that we've had, and I've only seen it repeated again and again, but I was brought in a decade ago by a conversion consultancy. They were like, come in, just help us generate ideas for like this homepage. And then there was a sign up form. So this was a homepage for a treatment facility in Florida. So a rehab center. And they were like, you know, doing all of this work to optimize the website. So they brought me in. And so I followed my process, this conversion copywriting process, which is go listen to what customers, clients say, and then find the gold in what they say and use that in your copy. That's really simplifying it, but that's basically what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're, you know, going to try to write copy for people who are going to rehab, it's very sensitive, right? This is a very like delicate situation, and I'm not qualified. I don't know any marketer on the planet who could possibly be qualified to talk to somebody well when they're going into rehab and then when they're coming out of it. And so I wasn't going to. I didn't put up my hand for that. I'm like, we're not doing that. We're not going to do interviews, which is normally what you do. You do an interview, like get on a call and say, like, talk to me about what was going on in your life when you first thought, I need to go to rehab. That's a huge moment. And most of them don't really relive it. And I get that. So we couldn't do the interview. So I did, this is very early in the days of review mining, back when reviews were reliable. So we did book review mining on Amazon. So we went over and looked at review, not at the books themselves. I didn't read the books. I found books that were on like drug addiction and how to get over it. All of a bunch of books on surviving alcoholism, or if your family is, you're the family member of somebody who is an alcoholic and things like that, right? And so I went through the reviews, and in there, as I was mining reviews to see like, okay, what are people thinking? What are they really going through when they're considering hiring a rehab center to help them through this life or death, in most cases, situation? High stakes. What are they thinking? And who would hire a book for that, right? Like, what's really going on for you? And in the reviews, one of the lines was, if you think you need rehab, you do. And I was like, I haven't heard it said that way. I had also done audits of competitor sites, and a lot of the rehab centers were like their homepage. You can go to any rehab right now, any one of them, and see that it'll be something quite soft. A soft message won't really say much.
Yeah.
And so this was coming out in the audit again and again. It's like, and I can't even, my so like against soft messages in most cases that like I can't even come up with an example, but like literally pause, go do a quick research, you will see this, and then come back. And so this one message, if you think you need rehab, you do, stood out to me, but it was one of many. I put it on a list. We had three headlines. The site had good traffic. We had three headlines we tested against the control, and we as consultants took a bet. We said, which one do you think is going to win? And there was a testimonial one, there was a data one, and then there was this, if you think you need rehab, you do. And nobody bet on if you think you need rehab, you do. So we know where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
It won by a landslide. It won. It beat out the data about success. Like, this is our success, right? Like, how many people are successful? It beat out the, what was the other one? The testimonial. Not only that, it not only increased clicks, which is what we're measuring on a homepage, increased clicks to the next page with statistical confidence, but by like 400% or something bananas. But on the next page, where you should not be directly influencing what happens, on the sign up form, it increased sign up form completions by statistically significant amount on that page as well. So we went from having a few empty beds a month, which cost $20,000 for the rehab center, to no empty beds and a wait list. So there's real money attached to this and real people who are going to actually get what they're looking for now. But nobody thought that one would win. Nobody did. And that is so common. And from that point on, and that wasn't the first time, but that was such a clear moment because we all bet on it. So from that point on, I was like, all right, nobody knows. Nobody has any idea what will work ever. It's just the way it is. Just be okay with that.
I love that. I love that because a lot of times, you know, everyone has their opinion on what's going to work and how it's going to work. And I've been in marketing for X amount of years and I've read these books and I've done this and I know everything, but it all goes back down to testing it. Now, let me ask you a question here. Why do you think most people underestimate the power of words?
We use them nonstop. I think just like a kid with a box of crayons where all they do is sit around drawing all day, they might underestimate the power of a crayon because you're just like, it's just my tool. I just use it all the time. I like it. It's easy. I get it. And that's just what we all do. And if we really stopped and thought about the impact of our words, we might not do that much communicating. We might not tell a story as easily, which would be unfortunate, right? So like there's a reason to not think too much, but when the stakes are high enough, it's a business, you're trying to get something done, or you're trying to influence somebody to do what you know they absolutely should do. That's for the best for them, not for you, for them. Then you should pay attention to your words, but it's an easy tool. It's an easy tool and almost all of us have access to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that a lot of times words can be a little more challenging in the written word because it's subject to a lot of interpretation. And one of the things that I'll use a lot is a terminology called, well, it's just a phrase. I didn't say she stole the money. 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 And so I'm changing the meaning of those exact same words by voice inflection, by facial expression, by tonality. And so it takes a little more work to get that in writing, you know, the prose, if you will, to really get that to come across.
Yes, it's great.
It's something that, I don't know, people will interpret words differently. For example, I gave an example to somebody. When I have a person that I like gives me a text that says, good luck, I look at it and it's like, good luck, Jim. And when somebody I don't really care for says good luck, I hear, good luck.
Yeah, that's passive aggressive thing. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that, of course, is lost in writing. Very often it's lost in writing. At least you can't have one sentence sitting alone and expect that you'll be able to communicate perfectly. Everything needs the context, right? Context of the speaker, context of the environment, context of the moment, all of that. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, when you look at like the average email or website or LinkedIn message, why do you think most of them are failing? What is there something that you find?
So what we see repeatedly is the things that are failing are the ones that everybody agrees on. And that's the problem. The most important thing we can do is be different. And people quickly jump to, but not different for the sake of different and not just leave that alone. Just be different. Start by just being different. Say something different. Say it at a different time. Say it in a different place. Have a different person say it. Different, different, different. And that's what I work with a lot of large companies. So I know that it's like, that is not some yes to the idea of it, no to the practice of it. So there's always best practices. And the best practice is you send an email Tuesday between 9 and 11 a.m. When is everybody going to send their email then? Tuesday between 9 and 11 a.m., right? So there might be an objectively bad time to send an email. Sunday at 11 a.m. might be an absolutely let's not do that. It's different, but it's the wrong kind.
Yeah.
But maybe instead of sending it at the exact same time as everybody else, and that's one example, this is just like being beholden to a better practice over the absolute best practice in marketing, which is be different. You have to stand out and you have, like, this isn't an option. And people often treat it like, yeah, but how can we really be different? We're not even different. There's lots of ways to be different. There's so many ways. Even if your product is exactly the same as the person next to you, there are multiple ways to be different. So many ways. Yeah. And that's where the opportunity is. Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the areas that people mess up in this, in their communication is they use, and I found this as a mistake of my own when I went to my boss and wrote this beautiful, you know, letter that I thought was just brilliant in the early 90s. And he said, Jim, I want you to take this and I want you to go back to your desk and I want you to circle how many times you use the word I. And I went through I. And when I hear it in speeches, when I see it in emails, when I see it in posts, it can kind of be off-putting and I can't get sucked into what they're saying. Do you find that, or is there some psychology behind that I don't know about?
We call that the you rule, actually. So the you rule is wherever possible, if a message is positive, do your best to open the sentence with the word you or your variation of the word you. So, okay. And we see this, you can do this on any line of copy on your website, in an email. It'll say something like, Drift helps brands find who's on their site. That's not true, but okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Great. That's about Drift. Cool. Like the ultimate rule is like, I only care about myself. So why are you making me interpret how a thing that you think is important for you should be important for me? When the easier thing is to say, you can, I don't remember what the line was that I just said, you can see who's on your site with Drift. Okay, now I am the subject, and that's good because in my mind, in my life, in my perspective, I'm always the subject. So I need to be the subject. I've survived as the subject. And so that's all we need to do. Just change it to you. Now, it's not if it's going to sound like you're pointing a finger, like you need to know who's on your website in a way that feels argumentative or something, then modify, right? Like, it's not like we're not mules. We can like take a rule and modify it if it's not working in that moment. But the general rule is if you want to make sure that they believe it's about them, structure the sentence so it begins with the word you, not I. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. And it makes a big difference when I'm preparing a keynote or going through a speech or telling a story.
Yeah.
I cannot use that word. I've got to just be really hypersensitive of that. And people will say, well, wow, you're a brilliant storyteller. And these are just the little things that I'm thinking in there, because I can't be the hero of the story. I can only be the guide. I can be the narrator, but I need to put the audience in that story and have them feel like they're part of the story, like they're the hero of the story.
Yeah, which, I mean, it is tough when you're telling a story, right? Because stories are typically told in the first or third person. So that's where it's tricky to get it in the second. But often if you start with the I, then in that case, like I, where I'd made this mistake, I did this thing wrong. Then, because we are all storytellers and story receivers by nature, we understand how to take that away as your audience, right? Like, what do I do with that? Versus saying, like, it's like people have tried telling stories in the second person. There are novels that are attempted, and you're like, oh, damn, you wasted a lot of your life working on a novel, man, and it doesn't make sense. But even if you do the third person, right, someone else that they can see on the screen, you're still doing your job in like supporting, because the audience is the hero. When we're telling marketing stories, right, or you're up on stage, the audience is going to be the hero. You're like Gandalf or whatever, the person supporting them as they go along on their journey. So people get that. But it is hard. It's hard in storytelling to go second person. Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Now, Most leaders that I know don't think poor communication is as expensive as it is, but you study persuasion for a living.
Yeah.
What is the real cost of bad messaging inside of a company?
Big costs. So, and this depends. So this is leader sharing with the organization. So how do you take... Right. So at an all hands or just in an email or whatever that thing might be. Lots. So I actually pulled up some data on this because it's critical. U.S. companies waste approximately $2 trillion a year on ineffective communication. Now, that's not only from leadership. That's like organizationally, right? That's just like someone said something wrong. And there's this problem with like strategic ambiguity that happens with leaders where they're trained in like media training and in just like general internal communications and as well as external with PR and stuff. They're trained to be strategically ambiguous with what they say so that people can take an interpretation and move with it, still feel like they're in alignment with you. Because if you're communicating, you're running, you know, Adobe and you've got a 20,000 person team out there, everybody will be interpreting it differently. And so there's often training on how to have this like unified diversity idea. It's what it's called, how to get people who are diverse to feel as if they are unified under this message, which is strategically ambiguous.
Yeah.
And that's like, and I get it. I get that everybody has all of this interpretation. But when you think about the leaders that you've appreciated the most, I find in my experience, and this is clearly not true for everybody because this is not the training that they're getting. I find the ones that where I didn't leave confused, those are my favorite leaders. Like, oh, I understand things now. Yeah. And so, but back to the costs of it, there's like, I think it's something to the effect of $15,000 per employee every year is what poor communication costs your business.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Right.
Now, a lot of times, you know, leaders we're all talked to or do consulting, I have to tell the leader that their email and their communication is poor. Mm. And they don't sometimes receive it well. I was like, no, this is really clear. This is really clear. And I'll give them examples of how it might be interpreted. But it's something that I think it's a self-awareness issue that people don't realize how poor their communication is until they have somebody like you in their life, Joanna, that helps them understand from a different perspective, because we all have blind spots in our communication and we can't see our blind spots or they wouldn't be blind spots.
And I agree with the blind spots. And I think that also as you move up as a leader, your behaviors are reinforced. You've done what got you here. Feels like, okay, good. So I should just keep doing that, add more things to get to the next level. But basically everything I've done so far is right, which doesn't mean that's absolutely what people are thinking. But I know when I work with people on internal communications and how they express things, some of the stuff that comes up is like, I've always been told I'm a good communicator. And oftentimes, and I'm like, okay, tell me more about that. Like, give me like a really good example of like when that last happened. And then and you'll see, that I've found this, I'm sure you have too, that there's this big bucket called communication. And in it, they put storytelling, funny, nice, friendly, and things like that. And so, or I run a really good meeting. And they put it all in there. And nobody ever said, you're a good communicator. But they said, hey, good job running that meeting. And you hear, I run good meetings. It's probably because I told that really good story at the beginning of it. And it's probably because I walked everybody through every single point on every slide and making these assumptions, putting it together, not double checking with anybody. How could you? That's not how life works. You have to like move on with your life now. So that's what I find is it's often just like they've misunderstood communication. And so you can be the funny person at happy hour and that can be really great. But if you walk away thinking that means the email you just wrote that's expressing something that's critical to understand, but is not easy to understand, if you think that they're the same thing, they're just not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're spot on that. You know, this podcast, I call it Speaking with Authority because leaders are communicating constantly. And from your perspective, why is mastering words such an important leadership skill?
For all of those reasons, right? What else are you responsible for as a leader but persuasion, but getting everybody on the same page? And that means employees, shareholders, customers, they're all your job. Like it all ends with you. But it's such a soft skill. You know, it's such a soft skill that it's deprioritized when you're earlier in your career. And then by the time you get to a leadership role, you have maybe had media training. Someone came in, a consultant came in for 2 days and they helped you figure out what to say when you're talking to the press, which basically led you to believe I should say as little as humanly possible in order to make sure that I preserve my goal and my status, or preserve my title and my status, right? And so that's kind of, what would you do if you are responsible for a $10 billion business? Where would prioritizing, am I talking right? Am I writing right? Where would you put that on your list? You've got so many other things that you're thinking about, not realizing that it is like a first principle kind of situation. You can't move forward as a leader at being a poor communicator. But there's lots of examples of people who have. There are just so many that it's like, why should I prioritize this? But yeah. Then you really great leaders. The really great, memorable leaders were outstanding communicators and storytellers first. Yeah. It's just, who do you want to be? Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, with communication, without it, you cannot build relational trust. And without that, you can't build alignment. And it's so important. We all have blind spots. That's why you're so valuable and why people hire you, is because the smart leaders know that they need to get better at this, and you're really good at it. When you go out and you read an email or website copy, is there a phrase or pattern that instantly makes you think this message is going to fail?
Well, the first one is, you know, if it's leading with the brand name or something like that. So that's number one. If like the opening word is we in your headline, redo it. So that's just going right back to the you rule. That will instantly improve it. Don't change the message. Don't change anything. Just reword it and keep it as it is. Copy changes, message doesn't. So that's number one. But otherwise, there's this ongoing desire to have the six-word headline. That, again and again, when I see that, and that is a universal desire. In spite of the fact that the greatest headlines in history have been either two words, think small, or they've been really long, multiple words, multiple thoughts, because people are thinking of them as a hook, not as a headline, but a hook. And that's how we have to think of everything. The best, the stuff that catches on most, I say the stuff because I'm categorizing social media across all of the different platforms, as well as websites, Reddit, all of these different spaces. What catches on most is anything that has hooks with embedded hooks. So you're always hooking with a payoff and having that like move people along with that momentum. But if you look at a page, let's say you're a senior product marketer or you're a senior marketer and you've got a page you're responsible for, you're driving traffic to it. You want the desire, the thing that the whole org will sign off on is a six-word headline. That's a value proposition headline, but it's not ever saying anything. There's no room, unless you have the most outstanding, like liquid death brand voice, there's no room for you to have real anything in six words. It is called the six-word headline in organizations. When they have like their message map that's up on a screen and you've got like headline and then supporting points and then like testimonials and data points and things on this message map, it says in many cases, in like several cases at least, I have seen it. They've said this, they call it that six-word headline, and you're not allowed to have more, and you very rarely have fewer than six words. And I'm like, who told you that? Who is the person I have to go talk to and get them to rewrite that part of whatever book they put out there that says it has to be six words? What consultant came in and told you it's six words? And I actually know which consultant group it is, but I wish that you would stop hiring this consultancy. Very, very large. They mean well. And you know, it's the thing that gets approved internally, which is one audience is your internal approver. And then you get to put it out into the world where it doesn't perform. But the six-word headline versus like, we look at the original great headlines.
Yeah.
They laughed when I sat down at the piano, but when I started to play it, they laughed when I sat down at the piano, but when I started to play 15 words.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's like, oh yeah, but that was a different time, Joe. Oh yeah, that was print, Joe. All of these things where you're like, also think small then. Fine. If there's that, the opposite is then think small. These are two breakthrough headlines that have actually shaped how people buy. Think small, Volkswagen, side note. Think small. It was was in magazines at the time, right? When it came out in the late 60s.
Yeah.
Late 60s. Yes. I know as soon as I say a date, I'm like, someone's going to correct me on it. That's fair. It's in that general vicinity. It's more people read the Think Small ad than read the articles in the magazine around it. Now, that's anecdotal, but like this was such, like, this is real, guys. Like, and it was so different from what others were doing. Think Small versus those larger long form headlines. That was that moment, that breakthrough, that difference. And so if we're all going to like stick with this 6-word thing, again, it goes back to difference. You're just going to sound and seem like everybody else. And the problem is, that's what most people want. They're safest there. Your bonus is secure when that's the case. Like, your job is pretty secure. So it takes a lot of effort to say, Joe, we're going to bring you in, or Jim, we're going to bring you in, and you're going to have to shake us up a bit.
Yeah.
That's scary.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. You know, when you think about words, there are words that move people to act, and then there are words that people just ignore. What's the separator? What a differentiator, or what separates those words that actually create people to move versus the words that people just ignore?
The ones that we've seen that people don't ignore are the interesting moments that come from voice of customer or voice of sales data. So that is when someone says something quite interesting. So there was a headline test. I was talking about this on just recently, but there was a headline test we did a couple years ago that was for a clothing website. It was like a site that will help you find the right sites to go to shop for your body type as a woman. And it was like the control headline was clothing, something like clothing you'll love that blank, something like that. Pretty like, okay, fine. It's fine. 6 words. That's okay. And so then we were like, okay, well, let's, you know, try to beat that. And that's the job. And so we went and listened to voice of customer data. So what are people really saying? Like, why are women choosing to come to this site to help them like curate their list of places to shop for clothing?
Mm.
What's going on for them? So we listened to voice of customer data, reviews, survey mining, that kind of stuff. And the headline that we tested that beat that was big bum ? Thick waist ? Not so perky boobs ? And everybody's like, ha ha ha, you say bum and boobs, you're probably going to beat the control. Fair. but this was voice of customer data. This is how people talk about their bodies. I don't come to the site and go, is this clothing I'll love that's perfect for me? I'm like, man, I put on 10 pounds because I took the summer off. Where am I going to find something that fits right? And so that's what we're really thinking. That's what we're really saying. So when you use that real language, which takes courage, right? And that's why A/B testing, although it's not as popular now as it was 10 years ago, but that's why A/B testing is so powerful, because it allows you freedom to say, well, we're just going to expose this scary message to 10% of traffic. And then if it performs well, it doesn't mess up our world, then we'll dial that up. But there's reason for people to be scared, and I get it, and I have to like help people through that process. Yeah. What we do is like therapy, but it does. That's where like the greatest stuff comes from. That's going to be the breakthrough. There are other rules, like if you put the word get in something, people like it. So, so that's like that's universal, right? It's very hard to have a button that says get or a headline that has get at the beginning of it in and not have it beat the control, unless the control is outstanding. But get will do it. If people are just looking for like a quick hit, use get.
I like, you know, some people were telling me about irony, using irony in a quote. Does that work? Or is that something that...
Like being ironic?
Well, an ironic statement, you know, kind of a juxtaposition.
Did you have an example?
Of course, you're asking me for one, and I can't think of one right now. But
did they have one? I mean... Because irony,
you know, and I was looking at, I think it was thumbnails with YouTube channels, and they said, be ironic in there because you'll get more clicks on that. And I didn't know if that was the truth or, you know, somebody had a unique take on that, but I just wanted to ask the expert, Joanna.
I wish I was an expert on YouTube thumbnails. We've got some good ones. I would say none are ironic. Mm-hmm. At all. The top performing ones are not. Actually, they're quite literal. Our top performing thumbnail, I think, is You Don't Need Original Ideas, and it's got my face holding two pencils above
it. I love that. I love that. Yeah, it's a great one.
It's fun,
one.
But it's not ironic. It's like, we're going to talk to you about it, and nothing about what you're seeing is like supportive or counter to that.
Yeah.
But as, you know, an expert in what I do, I absolutely know that I am not an expert in some things, including how to communicate on a thumbnail for YouTube. Mm-hmm. That is, there are smart people working on that. And if someone out there who's smart and does it all the time says irony works, I would give it a shot.
Well, but, you know, also in that, you know, Mr. Beast is the big one out there, but I can't have my thumbnails look like Mr. Beast. I'm a different genre. It's not going to work if I have Mr. Beast type thumbnails. I don't think.
Yeah. I wonder, because our thumbnails, that top before that original ideas with two pencils, that was swiped from a YouTube video for filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pencil that went this way and that way. And so our thumbnail guys just did that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's totally different. So they get a lot of their ideas from other spaces. But to fair, Mr. Beast is, you know, his own
thing. He's Mr. Beast, yeah.
Yeah, so his own thing.
On a different level. Different level. Well, let me change topics here. You know, when you think about talking to customers, great copywriters, they're going to listen to customers. But what does that actually mean in practice? Because it seems like there's more to it. You know, what do companies usually get wrong when they're trying to understand their customers?
They're not thinking of what they're going to do with the data. So I think that's why a lot of research groups and marketing groups don't get along very well. Although they should, just like marketing and sales. Like, these people should be eating lunch together and like going to each other's birthday parties. Like, y'all are trying to get to the same place. Why is everybody so mad at each other? But I think part of what I've seen is a lot of people don't know what they're going to do with the data. So they're like, you know, marketing insights team, just like dump whatever you've just learned on me. And marketing insights is like, or customer insights or brand, whatever it's called in a different org, brand research, all those titles, everybody's different. They'll, you know, do a net promoter survey.
And okay.
We've learned. And then it's like, cool. Like, marketing can't do very much with that. What would you like me to do with this? So what we have found when you're trying to get to good voice of customer data, we map the customer journey, the messages that a prospect needs to see along the customer journey across 36 points in a message matrix. And so if I'm trying to sell X product to Y customer, I need to understand how to move them from zero to one, to like this, I've purchased this product, I'm happy, I'm going to refer, I'd like all of the good things that make the ideal customer you want to get to. So to do that, we have to know, how do we even dig up? Because if I know what these 36 messages are that I'm trying to get to, now I can start to put together questions and where I need to ask them. So that you can just do like a jobs to be done interview. Fantastic. You will get so much data for the entire customer journey on out of a, you know, 1 hour jobs to be done interview. Do 5-7 of those and you're pretty solid. You'll have a lot, and that's really good. But then you have to be good at running jobs to be done interviews, which is teachable. Bob Mesta he teaches that everywhere all the time. You can definitely find out how to do that from the guy who invented it. But then others want other things, and that's fair. Some people don't even know what jobs to be done is. Totally fair. Okay, fine. What else do you do? So we also bring the actual questions to ask to get to those answers to our clients when we work with them. But that does mean that you have to get a lot. It's a slow process, right? Because you have to get one. For example, if we're like, look, one of the questions that we need answered in order to collect really good, useful voice of customer data is this one question. We call it the bridge. It goes, what was going on in your life when you decided to blank today?
Ooh,
what was going on in your life? Yeah. What was going on in your life when you decided to, or wait, hold on. Decision seems like too hard a word. What was going on in your life when you decided to? What was going on? Oh, that brought you to there. Sorry. I was like, no, I would never say decision. What was going on in your life that brought you to blank today? Wow. I've been using this question for 15 years and that's the first time I've blanked on it. that brought you to blank today. And so the brought you to is like a gentle thing versus decision, which is like, I haven't decided anything. So that brought you to, want to lose weight today, that brought you to download this ebook today. So it can be very soft or very like specific. But what brought you to sign up or start a trial today? All of these different things that we can ask, but we need to ask that on the confirmation page. We need to ask that as soon as a person does that action. It's a seducible moment. It's a really good time. You have to get a lot of people involved to make that happen in an organization. You've got the development that owns that landing page and has to get the question embedded on there. And what if we don't use the survey solution that embeds on there? So you've got to get everybody on board. And that's for one question. And there are going to be like six or seven we want to ask across different things. So it's really for us. If you want to get really good voice of customer data, you need to start by looking at the messages as a marketer that you need. How do you then reverse engineer the question that will get you to that answer? Work with insights to make sure that you're wording it in a way where you're not, you know, where you're not biasing, where you're doing all the right things from a qualitative research perspective. And then where to put them. And make sure that you're going to actually use what comes up as well. So you have to have a mechanism in place that's like every 2 weeks, we hold a meeting where we review all of the data that's come in that's more recent, and then we modify and adjust accordingly. This doesn't exist. People do not do this. If you do this, God bless, well done. Nobody does this. And so you end up having like end of year, we're going to work on our messages for next year. Mid-year, you're working on the messages for next year. And you don't have any data to work with. So then you get net promoter survey responses, and that's like what you get to work with. You're going to have a hard time believing there's anything good in voice of customer data. And that's because you don't think that your entire job is listening to what customers say and then mirroring it back to them, when that's your job.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things, an epiphany that I had, I was doing a consulting with a big software, you know, project. And one of the things, the product managers would go out and they would want to talk to the salespeople about, you know, selling the software and how they were using the software. And they would go out and they would talk to customers who just absolutely loved the software. And they would come back and they'd say, oh yeah, everything's great and this and this and this and this. And I just took it a little bit differently. I wanted to go out and talk to customers who were using the software a lot, but now they're using the competitors a lot. And what happened? Why did they go from us to the competitor? And they would say, well, the competitor has this feature, and this feature, and it makes our job easier. But it was something that they weren't going and asking the questions to the right customers. They were going out and kind of talking to all the sycophants who just love the product, and they're not getting the information that they need. And I think that that's really important to look at, not just, you know, your customers, but why are your customers leaving, or why are they buying, or why didn't they go to the other site that, you know, is not giving them what they need, or what you're not giving them what you need.
Yeah. And that's why I love talking to brand new leads and brand new customers. Mm-hmm. Brand new leads are typically in the, I have a problem, or I'm in this category, but I'm thinking of switching or adding something on. New leads, cool. And then new customers can give you insight into what was that feature that really took over the edge, and who was involved in the decision-making process? Mm-hmm. Like all of that stuff that you need to know in order to make sure. Because I like to talk to, when I'm recommending copy, I recommend that you write for the person in the room that's going to be like the happiest version of your customer. So I also like to listen to the wild enthusiasts, but typically not those who've been using it for a long time. And I also like to talk to the detractors, people who are like, no, I would never use this. I would never recommend this. Like, tell me why. What is going on? Yeah. And sometimes they're just like edge cases. And other times it's like really worth noticing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's talking to people at the right moment. Or what are you going to get if all you do is survey your customers once a year with or like after they cancel? Why did you cancel? There's not much marketing can do with that, man. There's not much you can do to grow your business. Yes, growth can do things with it, but it can't be it. That can't be it.
Yeah, there's a frustration that I think a lot of people have as far as, you know, whether their product or their software, their speaking ability, no matter what thing they're doing, it seems like you can have a better salesman, a better copy, a better, much better than what the product actually is. And sometimes people will buy a lot more of that product, even though the other product is so much better, but the other company just cannot communicate it.
Exactly. Then this is our job. Every product, every company has, almost every company has marketers at it. The product for every company is not better than the competitor, or else that's not even possible. So most products are not as good as if you used a different product. Okay, so fine. Now that we know that, our job, our heavy lifting that we do, the reason we get paid is to make sure that people somehow become obsessed with us. And sometimes it's just like looking better at the product where we're like, okay, well, what do we have anything like a unique mechanism in this product? And if you're not thinking that, if you don't even know what a unique mechanism is, then you're never going to ask that question. And you're probably just going to keep doing 6-word headlines and wondering like, what's going on? Nothing's really working. And not getting excited about your product because you're listening to a lot of negatives and some positives. You're like, why can't everybody just align and love us? But if you can start to think about how the really great stuff has been marketed over the years, not great products necessarily, but products that became the leader in their space. And that's like, for example, here with the with a unique mechanism. There is something in most products. There is something about how it was built, about who built it, Dyson, right? Dyson, although it had a different product as well, another part of their unique mechanism was the team that built it. Like nobody else could say that, right? But you have to be a smart marketer to say like, okay, we should probably mention that like, a rocket ship designer designed this product, right?
Yeah.
That should really come up. And that's part of the unique mechanism. And that's why, you could build Dyson to be like it is. I don't remember if he was aerospace, that kind of thing, down to like Scrub Daddy. Scrub Daddy has flex texture. They've called it that. And then they show you how it works. And now it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars and it's a sponge. There are better sponges on the market. I think we can objectively say there are better sponges on the market. But we've got this, the unique mechanism. This is why it does the thing that I'm promising you it does. This is how it works. And then a little bit of packaging and branding and voila, you got a big business on your hands. But that took smart marketers figuring some stuff out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, let me ask you if somebody's listening, wanted to dramatically become more persuasive in their writing, what is the one skill that they should obsess over that no one seems to talk about?
To get really good.
Mm-hmm.
There are like levels that I believe you have to go through to get to a really good state. Starting is just like, just put it in the user, in the alternative person's perspective. So your audience, your customer, the you rule is like layer one, right? Just make sure you're, what's in it for them? That's it. They only care about themselves. Once you know that, you're already light years ahead of most people. Then comes the layer of like Cialdini, right? So like everything in the book, influence, use social proof, use contrast. People like to act in keeping with their identity. So identity marketing, that kind of stuff. And a few layers up. Then we get into some tricky stuff. System one versus system two with like thinking fast and small, or fast and slow. It's Friday. I'm having a day. Read that book and that will advance you. And that's where you start to get into like manipulation and choosing the dark side or the light side. Choose the light side. And then the final one really is storytelling. All of it comes together under storytelling. And it's such a soft skill. I know that. You'll be a better storyteller if you've moved through all of those levels that came before it. But when it comes down to it, and this is why I think it continues to be in high demand, narrative, whatever word you want to use, because I know storytelling can feel weird, but narrative, having a story to tell and making stories out of every moment for people, they want that. They just, and if you want to be more persuasive as a leader, you work on telling stories. You don't get to just go up and tell facts or say anything. Start with a story and immediately people lean in. If I had told stories, I think I told a couple stories around like taking bets. People pay more attention to those moments. There is a story. I can visualize it. I'm there with you now. I'm hungry for that. Like, that's how we have always kind of unwound at the end of, like, after a battle. You go back, sit around the fire and tell your, like, battle stories. And that's part of what we do as humans. We need that. We need that from each other. We need that from brands if they're ever going to win. You got to be able to tell a story. So I would say, number one, although the other stuff is important and will make you a better marketing storyteller or business storyteller, just how people tell stories. Just step and practice it. You'll be bad, but you'll be better later.
I love that. I love that. Now, right now, today, we have this thing called AI, and it can generate words instantly.
Sure can.
But persuasion isn't really about more words. It's about understanding people. And what part of persuasion do you think AI will struggle to replicate for a long time?
You know, it's really hard to say. So some days I'm like, wow, well done, AI. And other days I'm like, oof, good. What? So there's a lot of like little tricks in AI, like ChatGPT's output in particular. Like we're all pretty wise to it. It's not simple thing. It's like dramatic thing. So color blue isn't just a color. It's a vibe. And that's so AI where you're like, oh my gosh, stop. So we're all a little bit like on edge with like, gross, it doesn't work. And then it'll get better because it won't take much for them to fix that. So for me, the things that AI continues to struggle with, has struggled with, and is likely going to keep struggling with are, you know, I hate to say it again, but storytelling, really, really good storytelling that's like natural and human, because it's not going to tell a human story, even when it recounts other people's stories. It's not going to tell a human story. And the other one is like kind of an interesting one, which is strategic word choice. So because AI is just pulling from everything, a generative AI at least, to reproduce things with tokens, and it's not thinking, it's not doing anything, but it does a good job of putting on a show of having thought and like paid attention. But there's like really strategic word choice. And the things that I think we're now being freed up to really think about are like the more academic stuff. So let AI write that first draft for you. Now let's go in and make it better, like way better with voice of customer data. Because while we mined the data ourselves and looked through it, we were able to find, if you think you need rehab, you do. AI didn't think that was interesting.
Yeah.
We thought that was interesting. One day it might, but so far it's not. So we get to spend our time going through because we're not generating a bunch of crap. Because we've got so much to do on our plate. Now we can do the good stuff. We can pay better attention to how people actually behave, real human beings behaving. And then getting into that more strategic word choice, which is like, this is one of my favorites, which is what we call money words. So certain words that absolutely shift things in an industry. So for example, infertility and IVF, multi-billion dollar industry in the US alone. It costs about $20,000 to $30,000 for a single round of IVF. Fertility, there was a study with the words. So the question was, which of these would you be most likely to support insurance coverage for? Fertility disability, fertility disease, or fertility condition? Which one do you think was the one that people said by a landslide they would support insurance coverage for?
Condition,
disability, or condition? Disease, number one.
Disease.
Okay. And do you know where it's called fertility disease? Mm-mm. Not in the US. It's a condition. So as long as it's a condition, people won't make that change. So you're like, okay, so what we need then is for people to start saying fertility disease. And then we might stand the chance of people actually having that covered. But in the meantime, as we call it fertility condition, it's a thing that and affect some people. It's fine. So those are the money words, and that's like industry specific. So if you work in fertility and you want to make changes, you need to start studying this stuff. And AI frees you up to do that because you're not scheduling anything anymore and you're not doing follow-ups. Like, you've got this now. And that's where like AI can do that, but we have to be able to then say to AI, hey, go do some deep research on this thing. And that's not a use case that people have because most people aren't thinking about that. But that is where I see real opportunity for people to keep like just nailing it.
Yeah, I think AI is a wonderful tool, but I think the challenge that a lot of people have with writing especially is discernment. They don't know how to discern what is good and what is bad. So somebody can come out and you know, you could work with AI and go back and forth, say, okay, give me three metaphors, do this. And it's kind of being a muse for you, helping you really get really creative things. Yeah. But a lot of people who don't really have the ability to do wordsmithing can go to AI and think, oh, this is great. And it's not. It's not. They don't have the discernment to see that.
No, exactly. Fair, right? Because I can go to AI and I can get it to generate an image for me. And I'm like, cool, looks good. And someone who's an artist comes along and goes, holy crap, that's so bad. Like, what? Yeah. Take that down right now. But that's because they're an expert on that. So they can tell bad. But we're currently in that stage of AI. Maybe we'll always be there. I don't know. But we're in that stage where somebody who is good at the thing AI is pretending to do knows. And it's just a question of where will we pick our battles?
Yeah.
I'm okay. If you want to do cold emails and you're like, it's a quantity game, I don't even care. Fine. You were never going to be someone who hired me anyway, because I don't do quantity. Like, that's not the thing. You were never going to hire any copywriter to do this. And if you did, they probably would be very upset in life. Like, it's demoralizing work to just like turn out cold emails. And so let AI do that all day. The rest of the work is for us. The good work, the fun work, the interesting work, the stuff that really solves problems. Yeah.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. What makes someone's words carry, when somebody speaks with authority, what makes people listen differently? What makes somebody's words carry that kind of weight?
I want to hear your answer on this. Is that okay?
Well, I think it's really, really important to have an empathy towards the reader. I get a lot of books, a lot of speakers, you know, hand me the book. I always will be gracious and read at least 10 pages of the book to go through it. But I have given my book to people who say, well, I give every book a 3-page test. If you don't get me in 3 pages, it's done. And I'm like, okay. And I felt good because they said I wanted to continue reading after those 3 pages. But I think that having the empathy towards the reader is one of the strongest superpowers, that you're writing not to just throw something out there, but you're really having empathy with what that person's going to get out of it. And that, I think that's what makes me a good storyteller too.
Is that empathy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, great for speaking with authority. Absolutely. And just to add to that, for sure, if you do start from a place of empathy, you're probably a better leader and a lot of things anyway. Probably a better speaker. You're empathetic to your audience. If you're standing at the front of a 1,000-person room and you're not thinking about them, you're going to see some people leaving the room.
Yeah.
The door opening at the back again and again. Like, oh no, I'm losing them. Yeah. And then on top of that, I think it is like this question of presence, which is like in human that's presence. In corporate form, that's brand. So like, what is your packaging? What is the way that you present yourself? And that goes a long way to come off as more of an authority. And that part of that is demonstration of confidence, pausing, strategic pausing, not rushing, slowing down and like taking your time, believing that people will continue listening to you, even if there's a pause, and like taking and practicing that sort of work, right? Which a lot of us, especially like creative types who are used to their minds going like, just go and get everybody excited. And you're like, you know, effervescent and excitable. That can be tricky. So you do have to like slow down and like be more deliberate and controlled without coming off as robotic. So it takes, of course, that practice, right? When we're talking about actually speaking with authority rather than just writing with authority. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think speaking, writing, it's just communication is so important. Let's talk about a practical takeaway. If somebody was listening and wants to be more persuasive starting tomorrow, what should they do differently next time they write an email or a message?
start by listening to your customer. It's gonna sound boring. Everything I say is like, it's like, oh, you already said that. Yeah, no, because that's like how it goes. That's the way we do this. It's not, you can't do it otherwise. So
if somebody was going to want to be more persuasive tomorrow, what's one thing they should do differently the next time they write an email or a message?
So it's that, yeah, same boring answer on repeat, but go listen to what your audience says and thinks. Like, just listen a lot more. And that's part of empathy, right? Is doing that listening exercise and making it a practice. That means actively stopping talking. Just don't talk. If you want to persuade your child to make their bed and they're talking about how they hate making their bed, if you listen to them, which I know is like, I'm battling this kid nonstop for everything. You listen to them, you will get to a place where you learn what's really going on there. And it might be, I'm not saying there's some deep-seated problem, but there's something, and there's a way that you can mirror that back to them and kind of disarm them with your understanding of them. So you no longer sound like you're pushing your agenda. You sound like you're aligned with them. So if you want to be that persuasive person, a salesperson is persuasive when you like them and when it feels like they see you and they hear you, right? When they're looking at you and listening, that's when you buy. That's like if you buy a high-end vehicle, it's not some cushy salesperson. It's a person who's like built a relationship with you, who thinks about you. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to do to be more persuasive overall. Take the time to listen to people and then mirror back what you hear. You rarely need to come up with something new. You don't even need to talk. They just talk and you say, I'm hearing this. And then they go, yeah. And then they build on it. And by the end, like this is how we get there. Yeah.
I love it. Joanna, it has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed this, talking about leadership and words. And I just want to thank you so much for joining today. It's been great. I'm so excited that you were on.
Me too. Thank you so much.